The second reading is taken from Martin Luther King's sermon at the Ebenezer Baptist Church on April 30th, 1967. The time has come for America to hear the truth about war. The truth is hard to come by because most nations are deceived about themselves. Rationalizations and the incessant search for scapegoats are the psychological cataracts that blind us to our sins. But the day has passed for superficial patriotism. He who lives with untruth lives in spiritual slavery. Freedom is still the bonus we receive for knowing the truth. Ye shall know the truth, says Jesus, and the truth shall set you free. Even when pressed by the demands of inner truth, men do not easily assume the task of opposing their government, especially in the time of war, nor does the human spirit move without great difficulty against all the apathy of conformist thought within one's own bosom and in the surrounding world. Moreover, when the issues at hand seem as perplexing as they often do, as in the case of this dreadful conflict, we're always on the verge of being mesmerized by uncertainty. But we must speak. We must speak with all the humility that is appropriate to our limited vision. But we must speak. So the inspiration for my talk today was trying to find the truth of my long life as a seeker of both truth and right action. And it's been a long journey, and I thought that I would, taking Emily Dickinson's advice, tell the truth slant, and taking Mother Wisdom's advice, also give you some stories. But I read Martin Luther King's Ebenezer Baptist Church speech, and it really seared my soul. And I do recommend to you that you read the whole thing. It's a really amazing speech, and it is so incredibly contemporary in every issue that it addresses. And that's, I think, the thing that is so distressing to me, and I tell you this because I do wish to speak to you truthfully, that I am, in truth, quite distressed. Like many of my generation, I grew up believing it was my duty to make the world a better place. I was taught, and we really endeavored, to see that the evils of injustice and oppression that had filled the first half of the century with world wars would be eradicated. Not just to work for peace, but we had to work also for justice. So it's a sad truth that I'm very, very unhappy about my success. And I'm deeply distressed about the world we pass on to our four daughters, my husband and I. And I'm sure that I'm not alone in this. And so I thought that in a community of people who have in their very words of opening that the search for truth is one of your deepest held beliefs and values, that maybe we could together muse on this and think about this and look at some of the things that people said through the ages and try and have some idea about what the truth of our situation is today and what right action might be. So most recently, and there's lots of things in the news to think about, but most recently we've been talking about the budget and the deficit. Now, if we're talking about the budget and the deficit, I guess we're talking about a whole thing. And I would like to say that it really deeply distresses me to hear people talk about a whole thing when they're really only talking about half of it. And that's what made me think of Stephen Hawking's illusion of knowledge quote, which is on the front of your order of service there, where he said that the greatest enemy of knowledge is not ignorance, it is the illusion of knowledge. So where we talk about the budget and the deficit, when we're only talking about half of it, because the thing that is never on the table is the 50% of our budget in our country that is spent on war, the preparation of war, or defense. So if we're going to talk about, you know, the budget, and I know I'm not an economist, and really math is not my best thing, but I do know that 2 + 2 = 4, and 4 - 2 = 4. So if we're talking about these things, let's be truthful about it. And the truth is that my life and our lives here in the last 50 years have been informed by this untruth, or truth, however you're looking at it, that what we have been moving forward and trying to do to bring peace, to bring justice, to end oppression, we have only been half doing it, really. So when I was 5 years old, I remember I first heard about the atom bomb. My brother and father were talking about it over breakfast. It was a Saturday morning, and my brother was very excited in the way, he's only a couple years older than me, in the way, you know, little boys are excited about blowing up frogs and stuff like that, you know, that kind of excitement. So I could tell he was excited. I didn't really know what he was talking about, but then he said, a bomb, Dad, like a bomb that's big enough to blow up our whole neighborhood? And my father said, no, it's a bomb that would be big enough to blow up all of New York City. Now, we lived in Staten Island, and we took the ferry into New York City, so although I was only five, I had a very clear picture of just how big New York City was. So the idea that there was a bomb big enough to blow something like that up was an idea that was just too big for my head. So I just went outside and did what I still do now, and I got on my bicycle, which was actually a tricycle at the time, and I started riding up and down the driveway trying to work out this really difficult thought that was in my head. And while I was riding all the way farthest away from the house to the end of the driveway, I heard this really strange sound. And it was coming from sort of behind the trees. It was a whirring and then a shaking, and then it was so loud and close by, it was enough to actually reverberate in my breast. And I looked up, and there, coming over the tops of the trees, was this thing. Oh my God, it was so big. It was huge. And I knew what a bomb looked like because we'd been watching, you know, World War II movies. That was my era. We'd been seeing them dropping from planes, coming down from this view. Every angle you could see a bomb. This was clearly a bomb. It was huge. It had a pointy end. It had like a little kind of fin at the end. It was coming right over our house. I turned my tricycle around and I rode up the driveway screaming, it's the atom bomb. It's the atom bomb. My parents came out, my brother came out, and of course my brother could read, and he read Goodyear. And it was the Goodyear blimp. However, I remember thinking about that for the rest of my youth, in fact, until I was pretty well into my teenage years. And I remember finding and being very moved by something I read that President Eisenhower said, the year that I was born, every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. This is not a way of life at all in any true sense. Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron. Not a day went by that I didn't think about the possibility of my family's nuclear annihilation. Would I be separated from my loved ones at that time? Would I be one moment a living human being, the next moment pulverized? This was the reality of my life, this fear. So life went on, and I became a teenager. We moved up to Brookline from New York City, and when I was 15 years old, I joined the United Farm Workers struggle through the grape boycott. And yes, you're right, I didn't in the interim labor in any fields, that is correct. But I was joining the grape boycott as support, and I just recently moved to Brookline, so some of my new friends asked me to come and join, and my mother agreed to host a house meeting where the host or hostess would invite friends to listen to a union rep from the United Farm Workers talk about the struggle. This was very effective, and since these people had no work in the fields at the time because they were blackballed from working, they were sent to large cities with social justice networks. They would be guests in activist houses, and then they would work to educate and further the effectiveness of the boycott to have the union be recognized. They would go into people's homes and tell their stories. I will never forget the young man who spoke in our living room that night. He was quiet, even a bit shy. And he spoke about his family, and when he did, a faint smile suffused his face. He clearly missed them 3,000 miles away in California. He talked about how cold it was at night, how he and his brothers and sisters were never able to go to school. He talked about how hot it could be during the day, and that a day's work was from sun to sun. He talked about how his family worked together, and no matter how hard they worked, they had never had enough to eat, or proper shelter, or any future beyond endless toil. He said sometimes they would be sprayed by pesticides, by crop dusting planes. And then he spoke very softly about one younger sister of his, who would have been my age, had died of a rare cancer, and how his family had no money or way to care for her. Listening to him talk with quiet dignity cracked open my middle-class world in a way no set of statistics or theories ever could. I could not sleep that night. Instead, I tossed and fretted into the early hours, wondering how, in a country that I taught had equality and justice and opportunity for all, how it could be that so many should suffer, and others like me in my family, in our modest two-floor apartment in Brookline, but we should be so lucky to have shelter, to have education, to have the food that we needed. That was a very big moment for me. And it was a moment that came at a time, at a big moment for everyone in our generation, where people were challenging and thinking about what we were doing in this world and what this world was like. It was not a time when we thought about random acts of kindness, and I think today, if Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy or John F. Kennedy or Malcolm X have all practiced random acts of kindness, they possibly would still be alive today. Instead, they spoke of intentional acts of resistance. They spoke of intentional acts of courage. And they asked us to do something. And many of us did something, and many of us still do today. But still I ask, why this lack of success? Why is it that we struggle and struggle and struggle, and yet I feel so completely distressed at where we're going and what's happening? Do we need, as FDR proposed 10 years before I was born, FDR proposed a Bill of Human Rights. He said that there should be a second Bill of Human Rights, and that these human rights would include the right to livelihood, the right to be protected from unfair competition from monopolies, the right to education, the right to shelter, the right to medical care, and the right to Social Security. He proposed that in 1944 because he said that the Bill of Rights we had politically could not really give people the opportunity for the pursuit of happiness that they promised. And without a second Bill of Rights that promised these other things, those political promises would be, in fact, bankrupt. Well, those truths and those lies are very, very important to me. The truth that people need that kind of support, and that we are not providing it, and there's nothing in our political arena today that really addresses it, is a truth that I struggle with and wonder what to do about. The lies that say that the problem is that we're going to help people in their old age, or all those other things, are just simply, you know, two and two makes four. I'm sorry, cannot go there. But the thing that does give me hope is the idea that when people share their stories and truly connect with one another, they can find truth, because truth is not a big canon or some kind of very important theory. And I do believe, as Unitarians put forward, that truth is a changing and evolving thing. And when John F. Kennedy spoke about peace just before he was killed in 1963, he said that genuine peace is dynamic, not static, and changes to meet the challenges of new generations. For peace is a process and a way of solving problems. It's also true that genuine truth is a product of many people's stories. And when we connect those stories, we understand the truth of our situation. But first, we need to know our own stories. And the thing that really keeps me going and makes me have a sense that there's some grace in the world that allows us to move forward and make changes, I was very early on, as well as challenged by learning about other people's lives and their difficulties, I was also very early on in my high school years given some good examples of what happens when people do get together. In 1970, I was in high school, a junior in high school, and four students were shot at Kent State in Ohio. And our high school held a meeting and decided that we would go on strike. that we would go on strike to protest that, but not just to protest it, but to go out into the community and to educate people about the war and what was going on in our country and what needed to be changed. When we came back to vote on whether or not to go back to school, two students had been shot in Mississippi. Two African-American students had been shot in Mississippi during demonstrations at their campus. And another 11 had been shot, some of them in their beds, as the National Guard and the, I believe, the state troopers had opened up on their dormitory. So the African-American students in our school came to our meeting and said, you know, when the white students were killed, you all poured out of this school, you went on strike, you made sure that the flag was down at half-mast. Now African-American students have been killed, and what's your response? What are you going to do? Well, a proposal was made that we would go stand around the flagpole. We would leave that meeting immediately and go stand around the flagpole, and we demanded that the flagpole be lowered to half-mast. So we were standing there, about 600 of us, around the flagpole. Nothing much was happening, no response from the headmaster's office, which was right above the flag and the gathering place. And then we heard police sirens coming, and we heard that. And then there was a little stir in the crowd. And I saw this little short guy who was a little white kid from South Brookline, used to drive his parents' own car to school. He was on the basketball team. And he was walking towards the flagpole with this really tall Metco student, African-American kid from Roxbury. Those guys were friends from the basketball team. And they walked right up to the flagpole, and the black kid put down his hands and gave the little white kid five fingers up, and he stood up and he took out, I was most amazed by this, a switchblade, and reached up, cut the rope, and pulled down the flag to half-mast, tied it off. And then we all stood there and bowed our heads and went back to class just as the police arrived. And to me, that was one of those moments that was a defining moment of how, where two people who had shared their stories had made some kind of bond and were able to find a right action at the right time. That there is that kind of amazing grace in the world when people connect truly with each other and share their own truths with one another. And so I ask that we think about this topic of peace, and we think about the topic of helping one another and those true human rights, and see if we can't find some right action that we can all do out of our own truths. Thank you.